So while we have people here, I will remind everyone that we are doing a Medicine Buddha Puja at noon tomorrow that is dedicated for Geshe Gelug's safe and comfortable journey home. He's leaving at the end tomorrow, taking a very long drive to Buenos Aires and then two flights to get to Raleigh. So if you can't come to the puja, just say your own prayers for him. Everybody always gets so quiet when we start the YouTube. Don Hendrick is here.
All right.
Hello, everyone.
Hey, Don.
Hey, Don.
Hey, Andre, Denise. Brandon.
Yes.
So many people, Jill, everybody.
Yes.
Wonderful. Hey, Donna.
Hey, Don, how are you?
I'm doing really well, yeah. It's cooled down a little bit here, so it hasn't been so intolerable. But how are things there? Things are doing well?
Doing pretty well, yeah.
Good.
We don't have any forest fires, so.
Yeah. That's been also an issue here in the mornings in particular. The smoke seems to accumulate, but not so bad. I don't have anything to complain about, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
Good. All right. So
Don, if we may, we would like to start with offering a mandala. And I know you wanted to say a few words about that, so I'm trying to figure out what's best. Maybe you can speak and then I'll put Laura on the video.
Okay. All right. Sounds good. Mandala offering is essentially, those of you who aren't familiar with it, a way of creating merit, especially in relationship to our teachers. And so you can certainly think about your own teachers, the Buddhas, all these enlightened beings that are there to help us, a bit of what we're going to be talking about tonight in regard to green Tara in particular. But we can think about those beings there, and we want to make this vast, pure offering. And when we do make the mandala offering, it is important that we think about everything being as pure and beautiful as possible. So you can think in particular about all the objects that you find beautiful in this world, that you find enticing, delicious, delightful, but thinking about them in a very pure form, not having the ability to sort of decay and corrupt and whatever that things in this world do, but rather in this sort of eternally pure form. And so you're making this vast pure offering to all the Buddhas, and then as you give that offering yourself, you can visualize receiving the blessings. We do this for teachers like myself, just symbolic of that. You know, you're not really necessarily thinking of me in that light, but you can think about your own gurus and the Buddhas and make the vast offering to them, but they're going to sort of symbolically offer that to me as part of this tonight. So, okay, that's probably enough. Okay, thank you, Donna.
Don, and I'm going to go ahead and put Laura on, and I will lead us in the chanting. Saji Puki Chukshi Meto Tramri Rabling Shi Nite Kien Padi Sangge Jing Du Mikte Ua Jetsun Lama Dampa Kenam Kichu Kukala Kense Chujin Tri Jita Champe Tuje Jin Ma Laza Ke Chuki Charpa Wak Tu So Idam Guru Ratna Mandala Kam Niryatayami. And now I'm going to share the screen with our prayers. Just a couple of preliminary prayers.
Okay.
Oops, that's not the ones we're doing right now. Just a chat. So we'll have the seven limb prayer and the refuge in bodhicitta. Gosum gu pe gane chak se lo no shami
to chetan lu bo
so gane chak se tum tam che shak ke pa ge wa nam la je rong Korwa matong bardu leg juke Drola churki korlo korwa dong Dog jen genam dong tuk ten porno. Refuge in bodhicitta, let's say twice in English and chant once in Tibetan. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha in order to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha in order to benefit all sentient beings. Sangye chudang so ki chok nam la chang chu bardu dagni kyab su chi dagi chun yen gi pe so nam gi drola pen shir sangye tru par sho.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you so much, Laura and Donna, especially for leading the prayers and for everything you did to set up these teachings this week. I'm very much looking forward to spending some time with all of you at Kadampa Center. So let's just do a short meditation before we begin, give ourselves a chance to focus the mind a bit. No doubt every one of us has had a day full of some activities, who knows what they were, but we've got a lot of things that have been going on, and it'd be good to spend a little bit of time in quiet so that we can let go of some of those distractions. So I'm sure most of you have a technique you already use to settle the mind by using the breath, but if you need a suggestion, I generally encourage people to work with the area around the nostrils. As you're breathing in and out through the nose, you're going to feel a very subtle sensation in this area. For many people, it's right sort of towards the tip of the nose, some people on the upper lip. But as you feel that sensation, just begin to tune into that and stay present with that. And of course, with any of our meditations on the breath, we need to check in occasionally and see the quality of our meditation. And if we check in kind of like a security guard wandering through and we check in and see that there's a problem, then we correct the problem. So if we check in and see that the mind has wandered away, gotten distracted, caught up in other things, you know, is thinking about what happened today or things that are going to happen tomorrow or whatever the case might be, if that's happened, then simply acknowledge that, let that go and return to the breath. And of course, if the mind is doing just fine, that's, you know, perfectly okay. Then you don't need to do anything again. The security guard can go on their round elsewhere and then eventually come back and check in again. So I'll ring the chime here to begin this meditation period. We'll do just a few minutes in silence, trying to focus the mind in this way. And then I'll lead you in a short reflection to set your motivation for tonight's teaching. So now let's turn our attention towards our motivation. And this is because the Buddha says that the results we gain from all of our actions depend heavily upon our minds. You know, what we do physically or verbally also plays a role. But it all starts with our minds. It all starts with our intentions. So we've gathered here tonight in this sort of virtual gompa to explore some of the teachings of the Buddha, particularly tonight's topic of how we activate the sort of feminine energy in our practice, you know, what that means, what that's about, especially looking at this Buddha Tara. And we're doing this because all of these teachings are here to help us to actualize our greatest potential. But moreover, we do that. We try to develop ourselves completely so that we can be of greatest benefit to others. And this is based on the most fundamental fact that was sort of the starting point for all of the Buddha's teachings. The reality that each and every one of us is driven by a desire to be happy, a desire to avoid suffering. No matter what being we look at in this world, we can see how that's operative in their lives. But in spite of that fundamental desire, have we really found the happiness that we seek? Have we achieved the freedom from suffering that we want? The Buddha's teachings exist because we haven't yet found the proper method, the path that will lead to perfect happiness, that will lead to complete freedom from all suffering, all obscurations. And what the Buddha taught was the proper means of accomplishing that. So as we are even advised by the Buddha himself, as we hear these teachings, it's important that we sort of take them in as something to be worked with and digested, to actually spend time thinking about them, to analyze them, to see them in the light of this fundamental desire, to see if they actually are there to create happiness, if they do that for us, if they do help us to relieve our suffering to some degree. But we do this so that we ourselves can, first of all, know the happiness and peace that comes from practicing the Buddha's teachings. If we do find that they work, that they have substance to them, then we continue to invest in them, and our own happiness grows and grows. Eventually, we achieve complete freedom from suffering ourselves. But even if we were to achieve just that, we would be leaving behind all the beings who are just like us in having that same fundamental desire to be happy, to not suffer. And moreover, we are connected to all of those beings. We are in a world of interdependence. So as we set our motivation, think about your own welfare, certainly, but acknowledge that the main reason to develop yourself completely is so that you can then help others to do the same. So hold that motivation, what we call bodhicitta, the desire to develop our own minds into the state of Buddhahood, so we then can help others to accomplish that same goal. OK, Okay, so tonight's topic, as I said in the motivation, is this idea of activating feminine energy in our spiritual practice. And again, when you read a title like that, it sounds very juicy, right? You know, so I hope I can live up to the title. But I have taught on this a number of times before, and I find it to be a really nice teaching. We're going to touch on a lot of things within the Buddhist teachings, but the larger part of the teaching tonight will be focusing on Tara, specifically Green Tara, who is a female Buddha. And we'll go into some of the aspects of that. I know you do a lot of practices around Tara at the Kadampa Center. I think you're usually reciting the Green Tara Mantra on Sundays before the teachings, as I recall. But let's go ahead. I'm going to share a set of slides that go through the material. It kind of helps, I think, for all of us to have a visual cue to kind of go along with what I'm saying. And then also it helps me to stay somewhat on track. Sometimes I find with these online teachings, because I don't always be able, I'm not always able to sort of look at notes that are on my table here or something, so it's nice to have them on the screen. So the first thing I want to start with is, you know, when we talk about male and female energy or what have you, I found this on the internet many years ago. This man named Shepherd Hoodwin, who is actually a channeler. I mean, he does some sort of New Age stuff, which is not to be in any way, you know, set aside or anything, but he has some interesting ideas. I've just read this one article that he had on male and female energy. And this is how he described male energy, and then we'll go into female energy. And I think it actually mirrors to a large degree what we are talking about in Buddhism, as well as what we see to some degree in our world. Male energy is directed, focused, goal-oriented, productive, and outward thrusting. It's kind of involved in making the external world what it is. It corresponds with linear, left-brain thinking and with doing. It has that kind of element of, again, accomplishing things on the outside. Whereas when we look at female energy, as it's described there, he says it's a creative, process-oriented, unstructured, and inward-drawing kind of energy. Sort of is about coming inside rather than being externally directed. It corresponds with circular, right-brain thinking and with being. So I found this kind of interesting. Excuse me, because we do get kind of caught up in a lot of things around gender ideas of male, female, and of course in our modern age where we live with a lot more sort of gender fluidity, maybe these things aren't so important to pay so much attention to physically, but rather at sort of the energies that are underneath these two sort of driving forces. So we're not going to be talking so much about the physical side. In fact, I'll share a little story here. I think almost all of you know Venerable Rabina. She's done some teachings, many teachings for all of you. She's been around. She was my first teacher in the FPMT, and I always, you know, have something to share of what she shared with me. But she was talking once because somebody in a class that she had here in Santa Fe was bringing up some sort of New Age ideas around male and female energy that were a little kind of out there. And Venerable Rabina was like, I don't know what you're talking about, male and female energy. Look at me. You know, I'm female, but look at my energy. And then look at Don over there. He's male, but look at his energy. You know, and so it was kind of like this idea that we can't get too caught up again in a physical container for where this energy abides, but rather sort of what are the energies that we bring into our spiritual practice, that we bring into our lives. So we do see that there are these two forces that, again, they're not diametrically opposed in any way. They just tend to be things that we, as many of us who are male, might be a little more outwardly directed, those who are female, a little bit more inwardly directed. But each of us has those energies within us. It's not to say, again, that we're exclusively one or the other based on the gender that we were born with. So this is what we're going to be looking at tonight, is this idea of how does Buddhism look at these energies, not kind of how are they in the external world. So tonight I'm going to talk in two main parts. The first part, and maybe we'll take a break somewhere in there, perhaps at the end of the first part, though we'll see how far we get. We might even be getting into the second part before we take a break. But even with the online teachings, I like to just at least have a five-minute stretch break. It gives people a chance to kind of get away from the screen and get a little fresh air, or exercise, whatever, walking around. So the first part will be the sutra and the tantra presentations of male and female energy. And I'll explain those terms for those of you who are new to Buddhism in a moment. Then we're going to look at an exploration of the Buddha Tara as a means to activate feminine energy, kind of how do we use that archetype, that Buddha, as a way of helping us to get in touch with feminine energy. So in terms of sutra and tantra, these are two kind of corpi, I don't know what the right word would be, of the Buddha's teachings, two bodies of the Buddha's teachings, let's put it that way. The sutra teachings are the ones that we generally talk about in our centers, and the tantric teachings are taught in our centers, but they are said to be the more esoteric teachings. They do involve a lot of teachings that are not widely disseminated, because tantra involves empowerment, a process by which a qualified master empowers you to practice tantra, to study tantra, and so on. But essentially, the Buddha was teaching for the sake of kind of two different types of beings there. Those who are sort of in the general understanding, who need the foundational teachings, because sutra is very much foundation even for the practice of tantra. And then those who, once they have practiced sutra, want a more kind of quicker and more efficient way of achieving the goal of sutra. Of course, the main goal of sutra is to become a Buddha. A Buddha is a state of being whereby we have removed everything that pollutes the mind, all the obscurations, and we have accomplished everything that gives us the qualities that we need to benefit others. So essentially, this is what's embodied in this word Sangye that we recited when we did the refuge verse. It was the first Tibetan word when we recited the refuge in Bodhicitta verse. Sang means to completely purify. Gye means to completely develop. And this is what our whole path is about in Tibetan Buddhism in particular, but any Buddhist path is about essentially purifying the mind to some degree and developing these sort of positive qualities, the wonderful things that help us to achieve our greatest potential. So Buddhahood is a possible state for every one of us because we have a fundamentally clear mind, a pure mind that can be rid of everything that pollutes it. And all the positive qualities sort of resonate within that mind and can be developed to an infinite degree. So the sutra path is one way of accomplishing Buddhahood. The tantric path is for those extremely courageous bodhisattvas, the beings who are imbued with that wish to benefit others by becoming a Buddha, that want to achieve enlightenment even more quickly. And so the tantric path is said to be the quick path, but it's the quick path for those who have that kind of unbearable compassion, that can't stand the thought that others are suffering because oneself is not yet enlightened. So the goal in both of these is a unification, a totality, kind of bringing together both masculine and feminine energy, sort of all of that into one package, a full, accomplishment of our potential. In our culture, though, we do see that feminine energy needs additional emphasis. That's why a teaching like this is quite useful and is also a draw for people, because we do see what has happened in terms of male energy in our world. Because male energy has been the driving force through mostly patriarchal societies, whereby male accomplishments and male ways of being and doing have sort of taken over, there hasn't been a lot of the feminine energy involved in the world. And I'm generalizing here. I recognize that, and certainly there are places where we have a much more balanced approach to things, or where maybe there's a matriarchy and very few of those in the world, but where there can be sort of a more orientation towards the feminine side. But each of us has these energies within us, and it's a matter of accentuating what it is that each of us needs. So I'm saying that in general in terms of feminine energy needing to be emphasized, but it's not to say that's true for any one person listening to this. So the sutra presentation, let's look at how sutra actually sets out this idea of male and female energies, what they're about. And it's going to be similar for tantra, but they're going to take on slightly different dimensions, if you will. The two elements of the path being kind of the practices that we engage in to develop our minds towards the result, they are said to be like the two wings of a bird. For a bird to fly, it needs both wings. And in the same way, for us to get to enlightenment, we need both of these wings. We need a wing of wisdom. And wisdom in this Tibetan Buddhist view of things is a feminine energy. And this is in particular the transcendental wisdom that is realizing this profound topic that's called emptiness, which I'll talk about a little bit later in a brief way. I won't be talking about it to a great degree, but I do have to touch on it as part of these teachings tonight. The second element, the second wing, is the wing that we could call the wing of compassion or method or even virtue, because it's sort of all of the positive energy that we create with compassionate motivation, with the desire to benefit others, with this mind of bodhicitta that we meditated on. You know, the desire to help others by accomplishing one's own full potential, by actualizing that. So that kind of movement, that developmental kind of side of it, where we are constantly putting energy into that, is masculine in Buddhist terms. And this includes our practices of some of the perfections, such as generosity, morality, and so forth, all of the things that are very active and about, you know, kind of being out in the world, whereas the top one, wisdom, is very much about kind of being in our internal world. You know, the internal world where we are realizing especially the profound wisdom of emptiness. Whoops. Whoa, got carried away there. When we talk about the result, so we talked about the path, which is what leads you to the result. When we talk about the result, the collection of merit of wisdom, this is how Rinpoche refers to these days, Lama Zopa, he puts merit with both of these. They're both a collection of merit, the merit of wisdom, which is how we develop that side of ourselves fully. This becomes, again, these are going to be a lot of terms, but don't get too confused about the terms, the truth body, the Dharmakaya in the Sanskrit, which is essentially the personal dimension of one's development. So this is kind of the omniscient mind of a Buddha. What is this? What is this said is that as you practice the wisdom realizing emptiness, you remove everything that obscures the mind till you eventually achieve the complete purification of the mind, by which the mind no longer has any boundaries. It is able to know everything that exists. The collection of merit of virtue is culminating in the form body, which we would call the interpersonal or social dimension. So this is the idea that, I mean, every one of us has both of those dimensions to us, right? We have our sort of internal world, which again is the more feminine side of us where we are more drawn in. We have the external world, which is the more masculine side, whereby that energy manifests in our relating to other beings. For a Buddha, it's no different. A Buddha achieves that state, but they still have both dimensions. They've completely purified their inner world so that they then have complete knowledge and ability about how to enact what they want to enact, which is the enlightened activities to help others in the world around them. So essentially, this is the sort of masculine component is when we have what are called rupakaya or form bodies, all the forms that Buddhas take whereby they can help sentient beings. So we see again that this mirroring of these two types of energies, the more inward drawn wisdom that we develop that culminates in our omniscient mind, and then the more outward thrusting and being involved in the world energy that is about collecting merit and being kind and giving and practicing all these things in relation to beings, that culminates in our ability to do that in the state of Buddhahood when we're most fully qualified to do that. You know, as a Buddha, you then have that kind of power to manifest in whatever way will be useful for those in your life, in the world at large. I mean, it's not just your life. It's every being who, you know, exists. You, is the object of your compassionate wish to benefit them. So these are the way that Sutra sets it out. Now, Sutra will talk about these two in terms of you alternate between them in a sense. You spend time doing the compassion and the compassionate practices and developing that, but then you sit quietly and work on the wisdom side of it. And although they're sort of there in the background, they're never brought together in a union until you achieve Buddhahood. Now, according to the Tantra teachings, they say, well, this doesn't create a corresponding cause then. If you're practicing them separately, you would then need to have them sort of separate. You need a technique to practice them together. And in Tantra, the techniques that are taught, the main one is what we call deity yoga. It is the time we spend in the wisdom of emptiness, realizing that, and from the space of that emptiness, thinking about being compassionately involved in the world through the form of a deity or a Buddha. So we're going to talk about this as we go through the tantric presentation. But essentially, Tantra sort of has the most skillful way of bringing these two ideas together, creating the best possible union or unification of these two. In the Tantra presentation, again, these more esoteric teachings, the two elements of the path, we talked about path before, they're combined in one mind. We try to practice them together with wisdom, which is, again, the feminine side, manifesting in what we call the path clear light. And I don't want to get into it. This is a whole course about Tantra, so I won't, you know, talk about what all the elements of those are. But this is essentially a particular level of mind that is realizing emptiness. It is specifically the subtlemost mind that is free of any defects or conceptuality or anything. And so we are abiding in that state and realizing emptiness. At the same time, we are, once more, the techniques of deity yoga involve us visualizing ourselves in the form of a Buddha. Well, as we perfect that visualization, even on the path, we are able to eventually develop what's called an illusory body, a sort of light body, if you will, that is still a bit impure because we haven't removed all the impurities. We're still on the path. We're not at the resultant level. So these two manifest in Tantra in the form of the mind that will eventually become the fully developed mind of a Buddha, that is this clear light mind that is developed on the path that knows the wisdom of emptiness, this subtlemost mind. And then together with that is the appearance in the form of a Buddha, an illusory body that, again, is the deity that we are practicing, the particular Buddha that you've been empowered to through tantric empowerment. But it's, again, still impure when it's on the path. When we get to the result, which is the complete unification of non-dual wisdom, meaning this, you know, supreme wisdom of a Buddha when it's fully developed, together with great bliss, the sort of blissful energy that comes from tantric practice, we end up with these two results that are together in one unification. We think about them differently, and we can isolate them differently conceptually, but they're the totality of an experience of being a fully enlightened being, a Buddha. The first is the result clear light, which is equivalent to the truth body in Tantra. This is sort of, once more, your personal dimension. You know, your clear light mind, completely developed with all perfect wisdom, completely omniscient, able to know everything in order to benefit others. And then the means by which you actually do that benefit for others, which is by having a pure illusory body and the form bodies that sort of follow from that. That is, once more, your interpersonal or social dimension. Now, Tantra, again, is taught as the quick path, but it doesn't mean that it's an easy path. It actually involves a lot of practice. I'm just giving you sort of the presentation of these so you can see how the masculine energy and the feminine energy are taught in both of them. But there is this unique sort of approach in the tantric presentation that shows how we need to bring these two things together. So here I'm going to read just a couple of small passages from Lama Yeshe. Lama Tupten Yeshe was the founder of the FPMT. Most of you know that. It's a wonderful biography that's just been published called Big Love that I hope many of you have seen. It's a little bit pricey, but it's beautiful. It's really quite amazing. I haven't had the good fortune of reading it all yet, but let me just read a few things that Lama Yeshe says in this book, Introduction to Tantra. The first is at the bottom of page 18. He says, "What we do not realize is that within each one of us is an unlimited source of both male and female energy." And that we have both of those again within us completely and an unlimited source that we can draw from in our spiritual development. So many of our problems arise because we are either ignorant of or we suppress what we have within us. In other words, we don't take full advantage of those energies. We don't bring them together and make them fully manifest in our being. Men tried to hide their female side, and women are afraid of expressing their male energy. As a result, we always feel cut off from something we need. Again, he's making generalizations there. There are many people who are the opposite, like Lita Vorobina, very much in touch with her male energy, right? As a result, again, as I said, we always feel cut off from something we need. We aren't quite in our state of totality yet. We're sort of always in some place of lacking. So he then goes on to say, we do not feel whole and therefore turn expectantly toward other people for the qualities that are missing in ourselves in the hope of gaining some sense of completeness. As a result, much of our behavior becomes contaminated by insecurity and possessiveness. In fact, all the problems in the world, from one person's anxiety to warfare between nations, can be traced to this feeling of not being whole. This is, again, a very tantric perspective that we're sort of not in our state of totality. Things are out of balance. Yeah. And so because of that, people are always looking for something else to sort of fill in the gap, and in the process, oftentimes not doing that in a proper way. Yeah. Because we're doing it together with all the delusions. We're not sort of free of all of that. A little bit later on page 19, he says, Tantra provides powerful methods for getting in touch with our essential wholeness. Tantric art is filled with potent symbols of the unity and completeness characteristic of our fully realized potential. The image of male and female deities in sexual embrace, taken by some early Western interpreters of Tibetan Buddhism as a sign of its degeneration, is a symbolic portrayal of the inner unification of our own male and female energies. On a deeper level, their embrace symbolizes the aim of the very highest tantric practices, generation of a most subtle and blissful state of mind that, by its very nature, is supremely suited to penetrate ultimate reality, emptiness, and free us from all delusion and suffering. On this level, the male figure represents the experience of great bliss, while the female is the symbol of non-dual wisdom. Thus, their union has nothing whatsoever to do with the gratification of the senses, but rather indicates a totally integrated state of blissful wisdom that completely transcends ordinary sense desires. So this is, again, just a little taste. Maybe it's tasty enough for you to become curious about Tantra if you haven't pursued Tantra yet. Those of you who are new to Tibetan Buddhism may not be ready to engage in Tantra at that level. But nonetheless, you know, hold it in the back of your head as something that is a recognition that somewhere along the path, once you have a good foundation in sutra, Tantra may be the exact appropriate thing for you. So I noticed that somebody put up about the title of the book. The title of the book is Introduction to Tantra by Lama Yeshe. It's still being published. It's available through Kindle and other various things. It's actually a really nice book. I know somebody, that was their first Tibetan Buddhist book that they read. And you kind of wonder, wow, that was some pretty interesting karma to kind of walk right in there. But Lama Yeshe makes Tantra very tasty in that book. He talks about all the ways that we normally go about trying to achieve that sort of totality, you know, kind of the ways in which we try to accomplish things, because we're together with all these different delusions and what have you, we end up with problems. We end up not getting what we really are seeking. Tantra is a specific technique that the Buddha taught to help us to accomplish that. So the other book that I mentioned, by the way, was the biography, and that's called Big Love. I noticed that somebody put that in the chat box as well. So again, the two books I've mentioned so far are those two. There's going to be a third book I mentioned, but I'll hold on to that until we get to it. And I will be sharing a few passages from that as well. So this was, again, the Sutra and Tantra presentations of male and female energy. We're not quite ready for a break, so let's continue on and do a few more things before we actually take our little stretch break. It was just, again, to give you some grounding in how male and female energy are being looked at in both of these. Now, tonight we're going to be looking at the Buddha Tara. I mean, you could say that all the Buddhas are a part of the sutra path to some degree, but when we start getting into specific images, again, I used the word archetype earlier, but there's sort of a way in which Buddha energy manifests in this world to help us. We do start moving into Tantra. This is why I felt compelled to share sort of a tantric presentation of these two energies with you. What we're going to go into, again, is looking at the Buddha Tara as a means to activate that feminine energy. Yeah. First, let's do just a short little introduction to Tara, what this being is about and, you know, who she is. Excuse me. The word Tara itself in Sanskrit means star, and it's from the root that means to guide across, thus showing her liberating activity, that she's kind of helping, like just in the same way that navigators would use a star to cross the ocean, you know, and by that star being constant in the sky at night, they would know whether they were on course or not. That's exactly what Tara is doing for us. She's helping us to guide across the oceans of samsara to the pure land of Buddhahood. So she has the ability to liberate us from everything that will become an obstacle on our path. In particular, the one we're going to work with, Green Tara, is an embodiment of that type of energy. Therefore, she's often called Tara the Liberator. And so this is, again, ways that you might see her name. Tara symbolizes the awakened activity of the Buddhas, kind of the way in which the Buddha mind manifests actively in the world. So it's kind of interesting, you know, earlier we were talking about kind of feminine energy being the drawn in wisdom energy, and then the active part of it being more masculine. But Tara has both components to her. That's why it's kind of interesting, even though she herself can be said to be primarily an aspect of wisdom, it's that wisdom being active in the world. I mean, if we look at the world that we live in, and I mentioned this earlier, and why feminine energy needs to be accentuated so much, is because male energy has made a bit of a mess of it. Through the patriarchal kind of stuff, we've gone in and we've ravaged the land and we've built so many amazing things, buildings and what have you, but we've neglected kind of the inner qualities that needed to be there to make that into a completely fruitful venture. So this is kind of the correcting way. Green Tara is a really powerful way of seeing how even if we feel like we're more masculine energy driven, we need to bring in the feminine energy, the more sort of intuitive wisdom that helps us to make better decisions about how to be and act in the world. If everyone who was engaged in that type of activity was more balanced in that way, we would have much different results from the actions of beings. But because male energy has sort of taken over through the centuries, that has been how things have developed. And there hasn't been, again, a strong emphasis on the sort of interior qualities that needed to be there and the wisdom to see what was the right thing versus the wrong thing to do. So this is, again, a way of looking at this in regard to this particular being. She sort of encompasses both, although we can say that she is, at the deepest level, an embodiment of wisdom. Green Tara, as I mentioned a few minutes ago in particular, is said to be when that awakened activity manifests in eliminating obstacles and bringing success, kind of helping us to plow through the nonsense. Just to get things done in a very proper way, a wise way. So what we're going to do in terms of the rest of the outlines, I forgot to mention this when we got to the introduction to Tara. I've got about four more outlines to go through in regard to Tara, is we're going to spend some time on each of these. That was just sort of a general introduction to the Buddha that we know of as Tara, which, by the way, I mean, I do want to mention before we go too much further that in the sort of Buddhist iconography or the Buddhist pantheon, there aren't that many female Buddhas. And a lot of people come into a Tibetan Buddhist gompa, meditation area, teaching room, and they look at all the figures, and especially if they're female, they might feel a real disconnect. Like, where are all the female Buddhas? In most of our centers, we have some of those Buddhas. There are many different Taras. There's Green Tara, who is this Buddha we're going to look at tonight. There's White Tara, who helps with kind of the energy of getting rid of obstacles to our long lives and to our good health and so on. And then there's a Red Tara and a Yellow Tara, and then there's the 21 Taras. I can't get into all of those tonight either in terms of explaining every one of them, not that I have that knowledge at my fingertips anyway. But Tara is one of the most common female Buddhas that is used. Now, there is also a Buddha that is not in the higher tantric teachings that is female, and that's Prajnaparamita. Prajnaparamita is the Sanskrit for the perfection of wisdom. And in that case in particular, you really see that that Buddha is intended to embody the wisdom of all the Buddhas. And the wisdom of all the Buddhas, another sort of way that we see it as feminine, is that it is the mother of all the Buddhas. Where do Buddhas come from? Primarily from the wisdom that knows reality. That is the main cause of Buddhas, because the main element of what a Buddha is that wisdom fully developed, the truth body. But that wisdom obviously needs to take form. And so essentially, we use female Buddhas like Prajnaparamita and Tara in her many manifestations to kind of awaken that side of us, that wisdom side of us that helps to cut through obstacles, progress on the path and so on. Now, when you get into highest yoga tantra, you do have a highest yoga tantra version of Green Tara, which, by the way, is the same as the lower tantras. It's kind of an interesting point about Green Tara. There's not a separate form of her. But then there's only a female Buddha called Vajrayogini, who is only at the highest yoga tantra level of tantra. So there are female Buddhas. Take heart, those of you who want to identify more with a female Buddha, know that they're out there. They're just not as populous as the male Buddhas. Again, perhaps an influence of our patriarchal world, and those being the primary ways that we sort of have archetypes of Buddha energy in our world. Just so you know, there also is a male Buddha that symbolizes wisdom, And maybe again, I can't explain why, if, you know, it's feminine, why particularly you have this male Buddha symbolizing wisdom. That's Manjushri, and he's usually holding a sword of wisdom that is flaming, so it can kind of cut through all of our ignorance and help us to achieve all the realizations. But nonetheless, wisdom is generally identified with that kind of feminine energy. So this is just a little kind of footnote to all of this, because I know it can be a little distressing to not see so many female Buddhas. You know, are we hiding all the female Buddhas? No, they're just not that many that are sort of out there in our world. Now, there is more than that. I haven't delineated a few others that are around. Even some of the early forms of the Buddha of compassion were in a feminine form, Kuan Yin in the Chinese Buddhist presentation and so on. But Tara can be understood on many levels. And let's look at a couple of the levels that we can go into on this. This is where I'm borrowing to some degree from a wonderful little book that Venerable Thupten Chodron put together that's called How to Free Your Mind by Venerable Thupten Chodron, Tara the Liberator. I don't know if that's backwards or not. Sometimes my camera kind of turns things around. Is it backwards? No, it's forwards. Okay, good. Let me read the stories that are from here, because if we think about her as being a historical figure, then there is some identification with her. You know, when we think about the Buddha's life story, in the Mahayana presentation, they say the Buddha was already enlightened when he appeared to be Prince Siddhartha and go through all of these different, you know, episodes in his life. And that's, you know, sometimes a little weird to say, you know, and for those of us who are aspiring to be like the Buddha, it sounds like, well, does that mean that everything the Buddha did was just a show and I don't need to pay attention to it? No, sometimes Buddhas appear in this way and demonstrate how to go through the stages to become a Buddha. But nonetheless, it's kind of comforting when we hear stories of actual beings who do become Buddhas. Now, her story is a bit, you know, spectacular, so I might have to take this also with a bit of a caution, because it is a pretty amazing story. So this is how she describes it, Venerable Thupten Chodron. She says, this is page 17 of this book, many eons ago, in a different universe, lived a princess named Yeshe Dawa. Based on her own investigation and experience, she had great confidence in the three jewels, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. She understood the unsatisfactory nature of psychic existence and thus determined to be free from all sufferings. Thinking that all living beings were like her in wanting happiness and not wanting suffering, just like I said at the beginning of tonight, right? Princess Yeshe Dawa developed genuine, impartial love and compassion for each and every living being. She was not enchanted by the luxuries of palace life, similar to the Buddha's life story, right? Instead, she vowed to show the way to liberation to millions of beings each day before eating breakfast, to millions more before eating lunch, and to even more before going to sleep at night. Because of this, she was called Arya Tara. Arya meaning kind of noble, superior, and Tara meaning liberator. Arya indicates that she has directly realized the nature of reality, again, emptiness, and Tara shows her liberating activity. Anyway, when the religious authorities of that place suggested that she pray to be reborn as a man in future lives, Tara refused, pointing out that many Buddhas had already manifested in male bodies. She vowed to attain full enlightenment in a woman's body and continuously to return in female form in order to benefit others. So it's kind of a determination to sort of go against the grain. And sometimes you will even see in some Buddhist teachings where there is this strong emphasis on the male body and the male form, which in Tantra is an absolute, you know, that's put out of the picture entirely. And even in the sutta presentation within the Mahayana, there's not much emphasis being placed on that at all. Sometimes they say it's good to have a male body, but that's because in a patriarchal society like we have, you have a lot more independence and freedom often as a man. Many countries still in our world that where women don't have anywhere near the freedoms and opportunities that men possess. But I mean, that should be corrected. I mean, rather than wishing to be born as a man, wish for freedom and independence for everyone, you know, pray for that. So here, you know, Yeshe Dawa, this princess in particular, you know, decided she would become enlightened solely in a female form, develop solely in a female form, and manifest in a female form. So she's kind of embracing that idea of the equality of all of this once more, the feminine energy needing to be there as well. It shouldn't be all just male Buddhas on the wall. We need our female images as well. In another legend, she says, Tara is said to have been born from Avalokiteshvara's tear, I mentioned Avalokiteshvara, you know, being the Buddha of compassion, who sometimes does show in a female form as like Kuan Yin, but Avalokiteshvara, as a bodhisattva, worked diligently to free all beings from the hell realms. Having done this, he rested about a while, but when he awoke, he found the hells completely repopulated with sentient beings, born there by the power of their karma, their harmful actions. For a moment, he despaired and he began to weep with sorrow for the plight of these ignorant beings. And from one of his tears, Tara emerged and encouraged him on the bodhisattva path, saying, "Do not despair. I will help you to liberate all beings." So it's kind of an interesting thing, you know, that if we go to that idea of Avalokiteshvara being the embodiment of compassion and Tara being the wisdom side of it, well, then it's sort of like, you know, the acknowledgement that we need to have both on our path, especially. Because if we simply go about things purely driven by compassion and we aren't wise in how we go about relieving the suffering of others, it's going to be problematic. You know, we're going to have despair, and we're not going to be able to keep going. Because we need to keep the wisdom component in mind, which is how to actually achieve the true liberation. Liberating beings from the hell realms is relatively easy compared to liberating them from all of samsara and helping them to become enlightened. You know, we have to have the wisdom side of it to help beings to achieve their greatest potential. So once more, the stories kind of point out where we need to bring both of those things together. Let's go to looking at kind of a second point within this, that Tara can also be understood as a manifestation of enlightened qualities, meaning that just like in any of these Buddha images that we use, that we have tankas of, that we meditate on, and so on, we're using them as sort of a mirror to some degree of the enlightened qualities that we have the potential to possess, but they are pointing out what it's like to actually have those. They are the manifestation of those qualities in a being, in a Buddha. So in terms of a short little quote that I am sharing on the screen here from Venerable Thupten Chodron's book, she says, "Tara is an emanation of bliss and emptiness. Within the sphere of emptiness, the absence of inherent existence, blissful wisdom realizing emptiness appears in the form of Tara." This is kind of that non-dual mind, non-dual wisdom together with bliss appearing in this physical form, in a form to help us and all beings by helping us to be liberated. "By appearing in this physical form of Tara, the wisdom of bliss and emptiness of all Buddhas inspires us to cultivate constructive attitudes and actions." So this is just pointing out, again, why we need these sorts of manifestations of these qualities in these forms, is because they help us to cultivate the same qualities through our attitudes, through our actions. As I said, they become a bit of a mirror, not that they're mirroring exactly what we are, but they're mirroring our own potential to become just like them. "By understanding the symbolic meaning of Tara's physical characteristics, we gain confidence in and are moved to follow the path she teaches, generating her qualities within ourselves." If we think about the qualities of a Buddha, how would those qualities look if they appeared in color, shape, and form? Even though all Buddhas have the same internal traits and qualities, they appear in different manifestations to emphasize certain characteristics. So this is the idea behind, you know, those two components of a Buddha's experience, right? You have the truth body, the culmination of a Buddha's wisdom mind, but then you have the form bodies, the forms in which they manifest to help other beings. Well, those are going to be diverse. Whereas the mind of a Buddha is sort of all of one taste. It's all of, you know, complete awareness of everything at all times, you know, complete understanding of emptiness, non-dual bliss, wisdom of emptiness and bliss. I mean, it's kind of abiding in this state, but that state needs physical ways in which to help others. So again, we have this feminine side, which is the complete development of that wisdom, and then the masculine energy, which is the kind of going out to help others. And as I said, although Tara is sort of on this branch of the wisdom, she very much shows how that needs to be manifesting in a particular way in order to help us, in order to help all beings on our path of liberation. We need that type of energy that is wisely cutting through things, not just going about, as I said, male energy left unbridled in the world without female energy kind of makes a mess of things, kind of destroys our environment and causes all sorts of problems and conflict and difficulty. If that energy manifests in the world from a place of wisdom, then we have a much different result. So here again, we are looking at the Buddha Tara in terms of the qualities that are a part of the Buddha experience, and particularly her experience and what she's manifesting as embodied in a physical form. So let's go back to the slides, and we'll just do a little bit of this. I think I may even have time to go through most of this, and then we'll take a short break. Whoops. There's a form of green Tara. I realized, you know, when I put this one together that it doesn't have both lotuses don't, or both hands don't have lotuses. So there is one thing I'm going to talk about where the image doesn't exactly mirror that. But nonetheless, this one has all the other features of a beautiful green Tara. There are many forms of green Tara even out there in terms of, you know, how they're painted and what have you, but they all have some of the same common elements. So let's look at what is involved in the qualities of Tara that are embodied in the physical form that we have. First, the female form, again, symbolizes wisdom. You know, that at the sort of heart of all of this is the wisdom knowing reality, that non-dual wisdom, and it's manifesting in this particular form as female in order to kind of indicate that. And this, of course, is the wisdom that we need in order to accomplish the entire path, really. It is the fundamental means by which you remove all of our ignorance and obscurations. The green color symbolizes activity and success. You know, in our world, green symbolizes kind of fruition, things coming into play. You know, the green of the world from the things that grow and develop. This is that type of energy, you know, her being sort of blooming, blossoming, kind of coming forth, creating that in our world. Venerable Tipton Chodron says, just as the air element generates the growth of green plants, which consequently brings the uplifted spirit of springtime after the dreariness of winter, Tara's enlightening influence makes our good qualities bloom and leads us to the freshness of liberation after the oppression of psychic existence. She's also said to be somewhat embodying that air energy that helps everything to kind of grow and develop. Then there's the body posture that she has, which is kind of interesting. You know, a lot of Buddhas are symbolized with kind of both legs in meditative posture, both arms drawn in or kind of nearer to the body. She's got her whole right side sort of extending outward, her left side drawn in. And it kind of expresses her inner realizations that are the left side, which is the wisdom side, and then her external outer activities that are symbolized by what's going on the right side. She has two hand mudras, mudras being the positioning of the particular fingers in the hand. And the one that is on the right side, which is again her external side, is granting supreme realizations, meaning she's going out of her way to help beings to gain realizations, to accomplish the wisdom and the development of one's mind and behavior, you know, in that manifesting manner. And then she has the three jewels mudra with the left hand. The three jewels mudra, I think it's usually done like this with the thumb against the ring finger, and you have three fingers up then for the three jewels. And essentially, this is representing kind of her inner quality of being completely in touch with her refuge in the three jewels herself. Of course, refuge in the three jewels is something we need on our path of development, but she herself is the embodiment of that refuge in its fully formed state. You know, no longer being having any hesitation about the complete reliability of the three jewels to protect one from suffering, to help one to be liberated. So she has, again, that kind of inner side that is the realization, whereas she's granting the realizations and kind of being outwardly oriented with her right side. Go back to the slides and do a few more things on her qualities embodied in her physical form. As I said, we don't have lotuses on both sides here. There's only the ones in her left hand. But the lotuses held in her hand symbolize purity and power. You know, lotuses are a remarkable flower, and they're a symbol of what we do in Buddhism, in that we kind of come from the mud, the muck of the pond, you know, which is what we are involved in now, the muck of our worldly existence. And lotuses only grow in that muddy part of the pond, but they come up above the water. And from the stem, you know, and the bud, they flower into a completely pure, untainted, unmuddied, unsullied flower. And so they have a kind of amazing purity to them in that, and they symbolize the ability for us to transcend from our ordinary sort of muddy, mucky experiences to that pure state. and even to use that on our path. And then, of course, the power that is symbolized there too, the power, the ability to do something that will cause some action in the world through the growth of those flowers. And that's kind of symbolized by, and you can see this if you look closely on your screen, the lotus, the blue lotus, or the Utpala, it's sometimes called, that she's holding in her left hand, does have one in the center that is completely open. That's kind of Buddhahood in its fully open state. Then there's one that is kind of a little up and to the right on the screen that is partially open. And that is showing kind of the intermediate state when one is kind of developing along the way, the Buddhas who have, you know, not yet achieved that state, kind of the Buddhas that are going to be, you know, blossoming in the present, whereas the fully open are the Buddhas that have always been there in the past or have arrived in the past. And the bud, which is the little green part that you see there, that's to the left of the partially open one, is symbolizing all the Buddhas that have yet to come, you know, that have not yet begun that process of opening. So we're somewhere in there, you know, we're either a bud or we're beginning our opening or we're fully open, you know, and none of us knows who's who, but nonetheless, that kind of shows that power of developing ourselves, moving along the path. Then we have ornaments, and again, various ornaments, jeweled necklaces, armlets, anklets, earrings, crown ornaments. These all indicate that the six perfections are integrated fully into her being and that they adorn every activity. So the six perfections are the perfection of generosity, of morality, of patience, of joyous enthusiasm, of concentration, and of wisdom. And of course, wisdom, prajnaparamita, the perfection of wisdom, is what is sort of Tara at her essence. But nonetheless, all the ornaments show that she's ornamented with all of those perfections, all of those perfect ways of being in the world. You know, every Buddha is no different from any other Buddha in terms of all the qualities they have. But once more, these ways in which they manifest are to emphasize particular things. Like again, Tara's whole energy of being withdrawn on the left and externally with the right, that kind of coming from a place of very secure wisdom to be active in the world, to help beings exactly in the ways that they need to be assisted. And there's just a few more things in regard to this. The outward extension, again, of the right hand and foot emphasize her compassionate activity, the method side of it, again, or the male energy side of it. The inward drawing of the left hand and foot closer to her indicates her inner peace that is gained through realizing emptiness, through her wisdom. You know, I mean, I find this kind of interesting in terms of, you know, if I'm called upon to do something in the world, say there is something that's happening that becomes a bit stressful. If I don't have an inner kind of stable wisdom that I'm coming from, it does become a bit of a mess, right? You know, I just don't know exactly what to do and I get flustered and I don't quite have the peace and serenity from which I can act, you know, I would be much more productive coming from that place. Well, Green Tara has that. She's sort of abiding in this inner serenity from knowing the nature of all things. She has no fears, nothing to get in the way from her side, and she can therefore actively be engaged in the world without any problem and know exactly what to do. So I love Green Tara. I think she's an amazing Buddha to work with. And then let me read this last little part that comes from Venerable Thupten Chodron's book. She says, Tara is also adorned with three syllables. Now, you don't see that in the Tanka because we see this as kind of insider. On her crown chakra is an om syllable. At her throat chakra is an ah syllable. And then a hong at her heart chakra. These three syllables embody respectively a Buddha's physical, verbal, and mental active faculties. You know, so physically om, verbal ah, and then mental hong. You know, and Tibetan Buddhists often say your subtlemost wisdom abides at your heart chakra. They also, subtlemost mind, sorry, I said that right. I thought I messed something up there. They also represent respectively the Sangha, which is sort of the body, the physical manifestations, the Dharma, which is our speech, you know, that's the main way in which Dharma is communicated, and then the Buddha jewels of refuge, the Buddha jewel being our sort of subtlemost mind that gets fully developed eventually. We sort of have the seed of Buddhahood within that. These syllables serve as subtle objects upon which a meditator may focus. They also remind us of the qualities we are developing within ourselves as a result of practicing the Buddha's teaching that we will eventually be able to culminate in perfect body, speech, and mind, and so on. In this way, each characteristic of Tara's form illustrates the path to Buddhahood and its resultant qualities. So that again was the second of these, seeing Tara as a manifestation of enlightened qualities. So let's take a short break. I have like 6 minutes after the hour here. So let's go till just like 5 minutes or so. So right around, it'd be 8 to 11 your time, just a 5 minute break in order to stretch, maybe get a drink of water, whatever it is you need to do. And I'll be back in 5. Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Don.
Okay, I hope that was enough time for people to get a little refreshed. So again, let's get back into what we were talking about. Again, we were looking at this idea that this Buddha, Tara, this female Buddha that is the embodiment of the wisdom side, the feminine side of our spiritual development, can appear in this form, and we can interpret that, you know, this idea of Green Tara in a number of ways. First, as a historical figure, we looked at that. Secondly, in terms of the enlightened qualities that are embodied in her physical form, we went through a number of those and kind of talked about what they symbolize. So that when we have a Buddha, a tanka or a statue or whatever of a Buddha, they're not just sort of a nice little image. They symbolize everything that is the culmination of our spiritual path, the complete development of all of these qualities. So now there's a third way that we actually look at or can think about and understand Arya Tara, and that's as our own Buddha potential in its fully evolved state. Kind of this is a bit more of that mirroring side, but recognizing that every one of us has the ability to be just like that. This isn't some sort of transcendent figure that, you know, we can never attain, that is, you know, way beyond our ability. It actually shows us exactly what we can accomplish. And so there's not really too much to say about that. I'll read the section from Venerable Thupten Chodron's book dealing with this. She says, our extremely subtle mind and body have the potential to transform into the fully enlightened body and mind of a Buddha. When we visualize Tara and regard her as the resultant Tara that we will become, we are inspired to train our mind in the path leading us to this result. And of course, this is where we do start getting into the tantric side of this. In that little quote that I just shared, there was the idea of first our subtle body and subtle mind. These are tantric teachings, and because in tantra, we are trying to work with the subtle energies that abide in the body and harness them together with developing this sort of subtle mind that goes with them. These are what become the clear light mind and the illusory body that I mentioned earlier, and kind of developing those two through manipulating the sort of energies, the wind in the body. But, you know, this is the whole idea of tantric practice, is that we sort of see these images, but we don't just think about them being something out there on their own that can possibly help us. The idea is that we think of ourselves in that form. That's what I meant, you know, earlier when we used the term deity yoga, that is unique to tantra. It's that process of bringing these two things together. The wisdom mind that is at its subtlemost level, eventually through developing the ability to tap into that. And then the sort of physical side of it, the subtle energies and so on, but thinking about those in the form of an enlightened being. Tantra is even called the resultant path because, unlike in sutra where you see it as creating all the causes and then somewhere down the line you'll be a fully fledged Buddha, tantra is about saying, let's take that fully fledged Buddha way out there and think about it right now, right here. I'm going to think of myself as a fully developed being. And it's not delusional because we do have the root or the seed for that within us. We have Buddha nature. We have Buddha potential. But it's kind of a very powerful technique because it involves thinking about ourselves in that fully developed state, even developing what they call a divine pride, not a deluded pride, but a pride where we think that we are actually able to accomplish all of that and able to enact the welfare of others to that degree. So again, Tantra is a very, you know, interesting and tasty way of practicing. And I'm not doing it, you know, proper justice, I'm sure, tonight in just this short explanation. But once more, if you're new to Buddha's teachings, know that the sutra is a perfectly fine place to start. And then when you develop some understanding of sutra, Tantra is a wonderful way to kind of complement sutra, and even, you know, sutra helps tantra, tantra helps sutra, can kind of go back and forth, and the two can develop together because they're both about achieving the same goal, just using different methods for doing that. And tantra is said to be the more profound and complete way of doing that. Let's go to the third topic in terms of this idea of what we're looking at of Tara as a means to activate our feminine energy. And that's just for me to briefly talk about what is this wisdom that liberates us and all beings. This is a whole topic in and of itself that I could do, you know, an entire weekend on, or week for that matter, which is this wisdom realizing emptiness. What the Buddha says is that every one of us, every single being, is obscured to the nature of reality as they come into this world with their ignorance, you know, drawn by their, you know, by their ignorance to take a physical form in a sense. The mind is obscured with regard to how things actually exist. And of course, one of the most fundamental ways that we are blind to reality is with regard to ourselves. The I, the sense of self that we are grasping at, even called this sometimes ego grasping, self grasping. We think we exist in some sort of autonomous, self-standing, self-instituting way, independently on our own, but we are a product of so many other factors. And so the idea of this wisdom realizing emptiness is the ability to cut through that ignorance that mistakenly thinks that we exist in this independent way, this inherent way. There's lots of terminology for going into this, but I think one of the most beneficial ways to, you know, kind of give a glimpse of it is to look at how we actually do exist. Because the Buddha never said that you don't exist. I mean, you obviously exist. You're sitting here listening to this teaching and so on. You know, there's some level of existence going on here. But what we think exists, the way that we think we exist, doesn't exist because, again, that's this sense of it being independent, standing on its own. Let's look at just real quickly, how does the I really exist? And there are three ways we can talk about it. The first one is that the I exists in dependence upon causes and conditions. The I is a caused phenomenon. You are a caused phenomenon. You know, through the force of your own past karma, your consciousness came into this existence latching onto a physical form that was, you know, the product of your parents, the egg and the sperm that came from your mother and father, that developed in the womb of your mother, that came out and started eating and doing all the various things we did, and all the various causes and conditions that have led to you being here right now, which I'm just, you know, going from birth all the way to here, where, you know, however much time that is. But there's many causes and conditions involved in that. We do have to say that there is no you independent of those causes and conditions, especially the most fundamental causes and conditions, which were the consciousness that came from your past life that came into the womb, and the raw material that this body was built from, the egg and sperm that came together in your parents' womb. If you didn't have those substantial causes, you wouldn't be here at all. You know, but nonetheless, there is no self that exists independent of that. You might think, oh, well, that's fine. I kind of get that to some degree, but what's the big deal? You have to go a little bit subtler. The second level of understanding that things arise in dependence upon other factors has to do with the whole concept of parts and the whole. We have the whole and the parts. Can you have a whole without its parts? You know, can there be an I, a person, without the parts of the body and the mind, which are the two main sort of larger parts that we could say are a part of our existence? No, because if we didn't have the body there, we didn't have the I there, or the mind there, we wouldn't have the I that is us here. You know, Don is a being who depends upon the parts of Don in order for Don to exist. So we kind of get that too. It's a little subtler, but we're still saying, what's the big deal? The third level is where it really hits home, and that's the understanding that when we think of these parts in terms of just being a basis for the designation of the whole, that there's no real whole, because if we go looking for the sense of a whole, we don't find it among the parts. The whole is what happens when the parts all come together, and we think of it as a whole. In the same way, when the mind and body are there together as they are in your being right now, you think of it as an I. There's no real I anywhere in these parts. The I depends upon the thought I, and that thought of I being generated in relation to a base, the base being the mind and body. So there is nothing more substantial than the thought I here. We think there's so much more that is here than that. We think there's a level of reality beyond that. well beyond that. We think the I has some sort of, again, concrete, independent existence. And we cling to that, and we operate from that vantage point. This is why we continue to go from life to life, the Buddha says, why we continue to have unsatisfactory experiences, why we keep from being liberated and enlightened, is because we cling to that false concept of an I. But this is true with regard to everything else. We also cling to other people being real in that way, being independently existing. We think everything in our world exists that way. We have to undermine this ignorance. This is what Tara symbolizes, is the wisdom that cuts through that ignorance, through proper understanding, through proper meditation, concentration, and develops an ability to cut through it so that we never experience that ignorance again. And of course, we even go beyond that ignorance to even remove the sort of subtle imprints of that that keep us from having the omniscient mind of a Buddha. But this is what Tara is liberating us from in the final, you know, sense, is this mistaken idea about who we are, who others are, what this whole world is. Yes, things do exist, but the way they exist is very, very subtle. Lama Zopa Rinpoche, the head of our organization, he says, it's almost as if the self, the I, doesn't exist. Almost as if, because we're really just nominally existent. There's just this being that we think of in relation to this stuff, but there's no real being. And if we think about the stuff in terms of the body, there's no real body, because body is also a label we put on this collection of parts. And if we talk about the head, which is part of this body, well, then head is a label we put on this collection of parts, but there's no real head here. And if we talk about the nose, nose is a label we put on these parts, but there's no real nose here. You know, nothing exists independent of our labeling it, our designating it. So in the end, everything exists in a really, really subtle way. So Tara is the manifestation of that wisdom active in the world, knowing exactly how things exist, knowing the conventional ways in which things, you know, then are operating, and being able to, from that place of deepest wisdom, act in the world. So maybe that's enough. I don't know. I may end up talking about emptiness here and there. I think it will be touched on to some degree over the weekend, but that's the third point. The fourth point is, when that wisdom of Arya Tara, green Tara, when it sort of takes shape in the form of sound, and some people use the mantra then in their meditation together with that wisdom that they're realizing of emptiness, and especially if you're doing tantric practice, her mantra becomes very, very important, an integral part of tantric practice. This is what we mean by the mantra. Mantra is literally that which protects the mind. What is the most far-reaching protection of our minds? To protect us from all suffering by removing that ignorance, by helping us to have that wisdom. So this is sort of the embodiment of all the ways that Tara is capable of protecting us in the form of sound. So the mantra of green Tara is this wonderful mantra, Om Tare, Tu Tare, Ture, Swaha. So we have kind of these three words in the middle. We have the header, om, and the footer, you know, the foot syllables of soha. And then in the middle are these three, tare, tu, tare, ture. They all sound a bit similar, right? That's because they're all sort of derivations of the word that means to liberate. So om, the head syllable, is the enlightened body, speech, and mind of Tara and of all the Buddhas. Om itself, it's kind of interesting in the, I think this is true in the Sanskrit as well. In the Tibetan, it sort of consists of three parts, the om syllable. It has the ah, which is the root letter that is used for all of the vowel sounds. It's sort of a default to an ah, but then we have a little symbol on top which makes it into an O. So the ah becomes an O. Those are the two parts. And then you add the little dot in the middle, and that becomes a ma sound at the end. So om has three parts to it that kind of come together that produce the om sound. You know, the ah default with the O orientation with the m at the end. And so when you have all three parts, you have the embodiment of the three parts of a Buddha's experience. The Buddha's enlightened mind, enlightened body, and enlightened speech. I didn't put those in quite the right order, but nonetheless, you get the gist of it. So this is how a lot of mantras start. They start with this om, like the mantra of Avalokiteshvara is Om Mani Padme Hum. This is om at the head of this, symbolizing sort of the power of the body, speech, and mind of all the Buddhas, especially of Green Tara. Then these three that are in the middle, Tare Tu Tare Turi, again, they all have the meaning of to liberate. And Venerable Thupten Jodrin says in one interpretation, they are referring to liberation from obstacles to generating the paths of the three levels of practitioner. The sort of beginning practitioner, that is part of the person of the least capacity, and then the middling path, which is the person of middling capacity, and then the person of great capacity, the great path. So again, we know these from our Lam Rim, our stages of the path studies. I don't want to go that deeply into those, but nonetheless, they can be correlated to those, to free us from obstacles to realizing the beginning of our path, the middle of our path, the final, you know, level of our path. Then we can also, in another interpretation, see them as referring to banishing the obstructions to generating the realizations of what are called the three principal aspects of the path. Three principal aspects of the path, that's again could be a whole nother teaching, a whole nother weekend, but they are essentially the realization of renunciation, which is the idea that we want to turn away out of compassion for ourselves from these habitual patterns that we've been involved in. This is a necessary realization on our path. You know, we all have to get to that place where we go, I've been there, done that way too many times. I'm up to here with my conditioned existence and I want the heck out of here. Then we develop bodhicitta, which was once more our motivation at the beginning of tonight, where we see others are in the same boat and we don't just think about our own welfare, we think about them as well. That's the second of the three principal aspects. The third is the wisdom realizing emptiness. So this could also be seen as tare tu tare ture, liberating us from any obstacles to realizing those three principal aspects of the path, renunciation, bodhicitta, and the correct view of emptiness. And again, this is what's necessary for us to fully culminate our path. So again, very much grounded in what Tara is all about, helping beings to be free of all of the obstacles. But there's a third interpretation, and this is kind of an interesting one, where we correlate these to the Four Noble Truths. Tare is liberating from suffering, or dukkha as it's called in the Sanskrit, the first noble truth, the unsatisfactory state that we find ourselves in. Tu Tare is liberating from the eight dangers, and we'll talk about those in a moment, which is essentially the delusions, you know, that are the causes of our suffering. All of our delusions that cause us to create karma, and that karma then gives rise to our experiences that we see as unsatisfactory. The first two truths are the Buddha's view of what we are involved in right now, which is what Tara wants to liberate us from. Liberate us from our suffering, liberate us from the causes of our suffering. And then Ture can be seen as liberating from disease, but especially the disease of ignorance. The worst disease that we've had since beginning was time, that we've never known freedom from. And that points to the third noble truth, the cessation of all dukkha, because we have removed all the causes of it, especially the root cause of ignorance. And all of that, you know, all three of those, Tare, Tutare, and Ture, are arrived at through the fourth noble truth. You know, we will eventually gain freedom from all of these, from our suffering, from the eight dangers, from the ignorance that's at the root, through the path, the true path that the Buddha taught. So this is, again, when we recite this mantra, we should be thinking of these sorts of ideas. That it's not just a pretty thing that sounds nice when you chant it. It's, you know, the embodiment of all of what Tara has the power to liberate us from. And once more, it is primarily wisdom that liberates one from all of these. Now, the swaha, again, is the foot syllable at the end, and this is at the end of many different mantras. And it's essentially saying, may this happen, may this be so, you know, sort of declaring this in a nice way. So the idea is, you know, om is that embodiment of the power of the Buddhas, you know, this liberation, more liberated, more even greatly liberated, may that happen. May all beings attain that state of liberation. This is sort of Green Tara's, you know, chant. She's trying to get us all to achieve the greatest possible liberation. So the next thing that I want to go into then are those eight dangers that were mentioned. Because once more, this is kind of one of the primary ways that we can use this Green Tara energy is to help us to overcome these eight dangers that are essentially delusions in our minds, that are the things that are keeping us caught up in our problematic state, you know, and how green tara actually protects you from them. So first, these eight dangers are said to be kind of obstacles on the path. They are things that arise in both an external mode, but they have an internal quality. So we're going to see, we're going to go through some beautiful verses that come from the first Dalai Lama that talk about these eight dangers. And you'll see that they are giving a sort of personification of each of these internal states that is an external, you know, thing that could threaten our life or our property. And then we have the internal ones that endanger us spiritually. But of course, these are very much caught up in each other. And that's because the external world is a mirror of what's going on internally. This is the whole principle of karma, is that what we do with our minds manifests in terms of the experiences that we're having outside of ourselves. So if you have external dangers in your life that you want to be liberated from, the main means of doing that is to be liberated from the internal causes of those external things. So it's kind of an interesting way of looking at these. And again, it's not an exact parallel, but it's a way of kind of manifesting some of those sorts of energies that are diluted in terms of experiences in our world. Like the first one is going to be the lion of pride. You know, we don't have lions all around us, you know, in everyday life. It's not like we live in some place where, you know, the nature hasn't been tamed to where those beings are all still kind of running around. But some parts of the West, you do have mountain lions, you know, and they have been known to be of great danger. So it's not to say we're completely free of that. But each of these is going to be sort of personified in terms of something external that could cause external danger. But once more, you see that the real root, the real cause that we need to be liberated from is the internal, you know, delusion that is behind the scenes, that is causing all of this. So it's a really wonderful way to look at kind of all the things that Tara is trying to liberate us from. And of course, we do that temporally, but we need to do it more ultimately through using the wisdom energy of Tara, that feminine energy of Tara. So how does green Tara protect you from these eight dangers that we're going to go through? Depending on Tara's wisdom by which she guides you, which of course manifests in the way that the Dharma comes into our lives, we can see even our gurus, our teachers as being Tara's wisdom manifesting. You, in caps, liberate yourself from these. You know, this is one thing that's really, you know, important to emphasize, is that Tara is not some savior that kind of swoops down and like takes you out of your suffering and takes you to the blissful pure land and you never have to experience anything ever, you know, negative ever again. This is not how the Buddhas operate. You know, there's that wonderful quote, I never have the exact wording of it, but it comes from one of the sutras of the Buddhas, that the Buddhas don't, you know, remove our suffering as they would take a thorn out of a hand, and they don't wash away all of our negativities as you would take, you know, wash dirt out of a cloth, nor can they take all their realizations in their own mind and plant them in our minds. So how do the Buddhas help? The Buddhas help by teaching the Dharma. That's how they free others from suffering. That's how Aryatara liberates us from suffering. So Aryatara is no different than, again, the Dharma that we really want to trust in, which are the realizations of these beings that are there to impart those realizations to us. They can't plant them in our heads, but they can impart them through the teachings and so on. So again, green Tara also symbolizes for us our dedication to renewing our refuge in the three jewels, especially our refuge in the Buddha Dharma, especially our refuge in the teachings, because the teachings are there as the means, the conduit by which we can access that same wisdom. But they're not going to be able to plant that wisdom in our minds. You know, if they could possibly do that, if they could remove our suffering so easily, they would have done it already, because they have this amazing compassion that really genuinely cares about the suffering of beings. So at the bottom there, it says, while we can ask Tara to save us from these dangers, we are actually calling upon our inner Tara, the seeds of our own wisdom and compassion. It's kind of one more, you know, sometimes when I teach on the guru, I talk about the outer guru and the inner guru, because the only role of an outer guru is to awaken the inner guru. You have all the raw stuff from which your Buddhahood can take place, can manifest. You just need to be able to tap into that. And once more, as we're finding tonight, we need to know all of that. We need to know the wisdom, the female side, the wisdom side, as well as the male method, you know, compassion side. But we all have the stuff within us ourselves. Tara is there to actually help us to awaken our own ability to achieve the same things that she did. So first, we practice the temporal antidotes for each of these eight dangers. And then of course, eventually, we have to realize the ultimate antidote of the wisdom realizing emptiness. So what I mean by temporal antidotes is that at the time when we're experiencing something, there can be some useful thoughts that sort of counteract that, but they're quite specific to that particular danger, that particular thing that we're working on. Whereas the wisdom realizing emptiness cuts across all of it. Why? Because all of these dangers are manifesting from that ignorance. They're manifesting from the deepest ignorance that we have, which clings to this sense of self and then tries to protect that self because we think it's real. We think it exists in the way that we believed in. So again, this is the idea that we will actually gain the most benefit from this by applying antidotes, sometimes at the moment in terms of what might be most useful, but eventually getting to the ultimate antidote, because that's the only way to remove all of these eight dangers once and for all. So these are taught by the Buddha to help us reduce and eventually eliminate them. So as we go through these, I'll touch on those somewhat. Hopefully we'll have time to go through at least a bit on each of these eight dangers. But the real protection then, as I just said a short while ago, is the Dharma. The true paths that are realizations of emptiness and the true cessations that occur on the basis of those. And of course, those are what Arhatara is an embodiment of, that complete wisdom, fully realized, unobscured. And so we rely upon the Dharma that helps us to attain those same states. So then we too will be liberated. So Venerable Thupten Jodrin introduces these verses, the following eloquent verses requesting Tara to protect us from the eight dangers, are extracted from this beautiful text, a hymn to Tara that's called A Crown Ornament for the Wise. It was composed by Gendam Gyalwa Drupa, the first Dalai Lama, after he had completed a meditation retreat on Tara. So the first verse is the lion of pride, as I said earlier. Dwelling in the mountains of wrong views of selfhood, puffed up with holding itself superior, it claws other beings with contempt. The lion of pride, please protect us from this danger. So once more, we see kind of this lion energy that can manifest in the prideful mind, the mind that puffs itself up and thinks more of ourselves than others, thinks that we're superior. Again, I won't say too much about each of these delusions except where it's necessary, but know that the sort of temporary antidote to this is to contemplate difficult topics or things, kind of see that we don't have all the realizations that we might think we have, that we're not as great as we think we are, kind of bring our sense of superiority down a little bit. That works with regard to pride. That's not an antidote for the other dangers, but it works very well with regard to pride, sort of humbling ourselves in the midst of what we're experiencing. The ultimate antidote, once more, is the wisdom realizing emptiness, because pride is once more revolving around the wrong views of selfhood, as it says there at the top. With holding on to that sense of self, we then puff up that sense of self and think we're superior. So the way to get rid of it at its final, you know, in the final way, is to remove the sense of I that it's built upon, that false sense of I. The second one is actually called the elephant of ignorance, but here we are talking about a coarser level of ignorance. We might call this sort of confusion or dullness, not tamed by the sharp hooks of mindfulness and vigilance, dulled by the maddening liquor of sensual pleasures. It enters wrong paths and shows its harmful tusks. The elephant of ignorance, please protect us from this danger. So, you know, why we're again delineating this as a different form of sort of ignorance, this is a coarser form, that is actually the sort of confusion we have in our minds because our mind isn't quite clear. You know, we haven't actually settled the mind through the force of mindfulness and vigilance or introspection. Mindfulness, of course, is a quality that we all need on our path that the Buddha gave extensive teachings about developing. Vigilance or introspection is like what we did in the meditation tonight when we started, that kind of checking in occasionally to see the quality of our minds. We need those applied in our meditation in particular so we develop a greater awareness of what we're doing, less confusion so we don't get caught up in all the sensual pleasures. We don't, you know, keep looking outside of ourselves for satisfaction. We begin to turn inwardly. This is the purpose of developing these qualities of mindfulness and vigilance. So, of course, those are the main things that we want to apply at the moment. But once more, all of that will be removed. Any confusion, any dullness in the mind will be removed when we have the wisdom realizing emptiness. The third, this is a, makes a good personification of anger, right? The fire of anger. Driven by the wind of inappropriate attention, billowing forth swirling smoke clouds of misconduct, it has the power to burn down forests of goodness. The fire of anger, please protect us from this danger. So here the idea is that we're looking at things inappropriately. All of these delusions have some level of inappropriate attention, but with anger, it is really skewed. We are thinking of others in a negative light that is not in line with their true nature. We are not actually seeing the totality of that person. And we are pointing out and focusing on the negative qualities and becoming upset and angry with the person on the basis of that. And it gives forth all sorts of misconduct. Look at what arises from the mind of anger. We do so much harm in the world by virtue of the mind of anger. And it has the power to burn down all of our good potential. This is one of the most heinous things about our anger, is it kind of destroys all that. I mean, even when we look at the more immediate effect that our anger has in our relationships with others, I'm sure some of us, myself included, have had times where we've had an episode with somebody that damaged the relationship beyond repair, where, you know, that moment of anger and how it flamed up and just caused so much mayhem, you couldn't get back to the place you were before that. You know, whatever good the relation was in the relationship before that got consumed by those moments of anger, you know, irreparable damage. So again, this points to the faults of anger. Well, the main ways that we fight anger on a temporal basis, of course, are through the practice of patience, and patience that has a sort of loving quality to it, where we begin to see the more positive aspects of that person. We see how they are suffering under the control of their own delusions, and we don't completely hold them accountable because they don't even have, you know, the understanding of that, much less the tools to fight it. And we develop a real ability to bear the harm of others and not let our minds get disturbed, because we don't want to harm others. We have a compassionate motivation. So through loving kindness and compassion that infuse our patience, we can overcome that in the moment. But how do you get rid of anger completely? By realizing emptiness, by realizing that the self, the I that is at the source of all of this, doesn't exist in the way that we think it does. Again, I does exist, but very subtly, as we call it, the merely imputed I, the merely designated I, the I that we think of in relation to this stuff, that has nothing more substantial to it than that. It's just a thought, an idea in relation to that. Correct idea, no problem. It's correct conventionally to think of this as I, but there's nothing more here that is I. So again, this is what Tara is there to help us to do, is to be free of our ignorance that is at the root of this, and even to help us to put out the fires of anger through our own conventional understanding of things and developing loving kindness and compassion. Because, you know, all the Buddhas are imbued, again, equally with compassion. This is why Tara does what she does, is because she has compassionate motivation. The snake of jealousy. Lurking in its dark pit of ignorance, unable to bear the wealth and excellence of others, it swiftly injects them with its cruel poison. This is kind of a nice analogy for our jealousy, right? The snake of jealousy. Please protect us from this danger. You know, the mind that can't bear others having things that we think we should have, and so on. You know, this is how it manifests. It's very snake-like, kind of getting in there and poisoning others because of our desire for what they have. And so again, how do we counteract this in the moment through a temporal antidote? Through rejoicing in the good fortune of others. Be happy that others have wealth and have excellence in their lives. They didn't get those things on their own. They got them through their good actions in the past. Karmically, that's the only way to get these things. The only way for somebody to be rich in this world is to have developed the karma to be rich. Yes, they engage in the specific activities that cause them to accumulate wealth through their, you know, startup company or whatever it was that they did. But a lot of people do those things and don't get wealthy. They had the karma to get wealthy from that. That was a condition that led them to have that. We should be rejoicing that others exhibited some good behavior in the past that led them to these positive things. We shouldn't be getting jealous. And how do we get rid of our jealousy at an ultimate level? The wisdom realizing emptiness. Then we have the thieves of wrong views. They kind of, you know, rob us of the things that we really want to have, good understanding and so on. Roaming the fearful wilds of inferior practice and the barren wastes of absolutism and nihilism, they sack the towns and hermitages of benefit and bliss, the thieves of wrong views. Please protect us from this danger. There are a number of wrong views. One of the wrong views is not holding to the idea of karma, you know, thinking that there's no logic for why beings experience suffering, happiness, what have you. Another one can be, you know, the wrong view that thinks that Buddhahood is not possible. But here we're talking about primarily the two views that are mentioned in the second line. Absolutism, which is our adherence to things as having some sort of eternal nature, and nihilism, where we start hearing that things don't have, you know, the nature that we think they do, and we think things don't exist at all. And we can kind of go back and forth between these to some degree. They are called the two extreme views. We need to find the middle way view between these. This is actually what will help us to overcome those two extreme views, to keep investing in study and practice that helps us to gain correct views of things. But to eliminate what's behind all of them, we have to realize, you know, perfect emptiness. Then the chain or the binds of miserliness, the shackles, if you will, of miserliness, binding embodied beings in the unbearable prison of cyclic existence with no freedom. It locks them in craving's tight embrace. The chain of miserliness, please protect us from this danger. You know, in the very first sutra that the Buddha taught, the Sutra of the Four Noble Truths, when he pointed to the cause of why we are bound in existence, what creates the shackle at the closest level, it's desire, it's miserliness, it's our attachment. It's kind of the clinging tight to things and not wanting to let go. Become painful during this life, but it's also painful at the end of this life. You know, we should be very free, giving of our things, and this is the antidote to that, is to practice generosity in the moment, to think we're going to have to let go of all these things at the end of this life anyway. You can't take a single thing with you, so why are you holding on to it so tightly, collecting it and keeping it in accounts and doing whatever? I mean, we need to be more free-flowing with the things that we have and not hold on to them with such miserliness. Of course, the final antidote to miserliness, because it's revolving around the I, is our wisdom realizing emptiness, that the I doesn't exist in that way. Then we have the flood of attachment, which is kind of, again, attachment and miserliness have things in common. They are the same type of mind. Miserliness just manifests in terms of our holding tight to things. Attachment means that we have a strong sense of possession of things, and we don't want to let go of them at all. This, too, can become very problematic at the end of this life. If we've lived our lives with great attachment to all of our physical things and so on, it's very problematic. So here, Gendun Drupa says, sweeping us in the torrent of psychic existence so hard to cross, where, conditioned by the propelling winds of karma, we are tossed in the waves of birth, aging, sickness, and death. The flood of attachment, please protect us from this danger. Of course, parts of the United States are experiencing floods to some degree, and will be experiencing potentially even greater floods with the hurricanes and so on. You know, it's kind of an interesting analogy again for attachment. It kind of floods us in that. It doesn't allow you to sort of escape. You drown in it. You know, we are drowning in our own attachment. Can certainly see how this is working in our world, and it gives us only continued rebirth by our strong attachment to existence, our strong attachment to the things that we have, and so on. So what is the antidote to attachment? The antidote is contemplating the impermanent nature of things, the fleeting nature of things, that we do have to let them go, you know. And therefore, we shouldn't be clinging so tight. Even this life, you will have to let go at the end of it. So again, and the ultimate antidote is the wisdom realizing emptiness. Finally, the eighth danger, the carnivorous demon of doubt. And we're talking about here afflicted doubt. You know, you can have some doubt about the Buddha's teachings. In fact, you're encouraged to have some level of doubt. So you investigate them fully and don't just take them on the surface as being true. But here it's when afflicted doubt arises, where you can't go in one direction or the other because you're confused as to what is correct. You have a two-pointed mind. roaming in the space of darkest confusion, tormenting those who strive for ultimate aims. It is viciously lethal to liberation, the carnivorous demon of doubt. Please protect us from this danger. It's a carnivorous demon because it kind of eats up all of the potential that we have. If we live our lives in doubt about the Buddha's teachings, we never go forward. It kind of destroys all the potential that we have, squanders our chance for liberation. So how do we get rid of our doubt? By doing deeper investigation into things, you know, trying to examine the contradictory thoughts and come to some clarity about how things actually are. So once more, we see that with all eight of these, there's a temporary way that we can sort of combat them in the moment, but then there's the underwriting, you know, wisdom realizing emptiness that will get rid of your doubt, that will get rid of, you know, all the various afflictions that we have. And this is Tara. This is what Tara symbolizes, is the ability to kind of cut through at both of these levels, cut through at the temporal levels, helping us to apply appropriately what it is that we need to in the moment, but then also cutting through at the deepest level through the wisdom realizing emptiness, which is essential for us to ever be free. So when we're invoking Tara, we're trying to activate once more that kind of feminine energy, that wisdom energy that is so central to the Buddhist path. You know, without it, we're never going to accomplish any of the more long-lasting goals. Even the temporary goals will be much less attainable if we can't apply some measure of the Buddhist teachings. So let me go back to the slides. I don't have so much more to go through on the slides. Just a few last comments, and there's actually a dedication verse that comes at the end. Here's the dedication verse. Through these praises and requests to you, you know, to Tara, quell conditions unfavorable for Dharma practice and let us have long life, positive potential, glory, plenty, and other conducive conditions as we wish. And some concluding advice, you know, that Venerable Thupten Chodron gives on this is that we should unite those kinds of requests. Many people, again, do call upon Tara at times to help them with their spiritual practice. Well, unite it with the wisdom of emptiness of the three spheres, that you yourself are empty of inherent existence, you don't exist independently, that your action that you are engaging in of making requests doesn't exist inherently, that Arya Tara that you are asking requests from doesn't exist inherently. You know, the action we're engaging in, the object of the action and the subject of the action, none of those exist inherently, independently. Then while requesting Tara, invoking our internal wisdom and compassion, the greater our wisdom of emptiness, of ultimate reality, the more Tara can inspire us to deepen our realizations. So that's the slideshow. So I want to tell one story here because I've got a little bit of time, and I was really touched by this story, but I've heard stories from a number of people in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition about Green Tara and how she's played a role when they've made heartfelt requests and maybe again united it with some of these deeper wisdom, compassion in the way that Venerable Thupten Chodron was encouraging us to do. This was a little story that a friend of mine who is a Zen practitioner who lived here in Santa Fe and was actually living at Upaya Zen Center, where Joan Halifax Roshi, her center here. And she would come to my teachings, though, because she liked to, this was actually teachings on the Bodhisattva Charyavatara, Shantideva's text. And she told me this story once about Green Tara that kind of gave me chills. But she was saying, she's British, and she was staying at a center in Wales. I think it's called Lam Rim Center. And there's a lot of woods in the area. And students sometimes wander out and do some hikes and that. And there was a woman on a particular day that wandered out and didn't come home by dusk. And they were a bit worried for her. And it got to be dark then, and they were like, oh, no, you know, where is she? She must have gotten lost. So they asked the Geshe, who was there, their resident teacher, you know, if they should, you know, what they should do. And he said, well, he was in the upstairs area of the Gompa in his room. He said, go down to the Gompa and gather everybody together and do praises to the 21 Taras, you know, working with Green Tara and this kind of Tara energy. And so they started, and they were doing all the recitations of the praises. Many of you have done the praises many times, I'm sure. And then all of a sudden, they hear like a thump, thump, thump from upstairs, like, okay, you can stop now. And then within minutes, this woman appears, and she's coming out of the woods and, you know, happy to have found the center again. And they asked her, they said, well, what happened? And she said, oh, I was out wandering, and I got totally disoriented, and then it started getting dark, and I got completely lost. And then in the dark, I saw a green light, and I followed the green light, and it took me back to the center. And there's no light neon light at the center that's green. They don't have like a little flashing Tara or something. But, you know, this is the way Tara works sometimes. And of course, maybe this is the power of the Geshe there, who maybe he's quite a realized being and able through his compassion and wisdom be able to benefit others in this way, to lead them out of the danger that this woman was in particular. You know, but nonetheless, other people tell me stories that are along these same lines. I think Tara is very powerful, but that's because you're dealing with her being the embodiment of the most powerful antidote we can bring to our practice, which is the wisdom realizing how things actually are. So that's what I wanted to share with all of you tonight. And I hope this was useful. I realize it was a lot of information. I don't know if there's an easy way for me to make some of these slides available. I'm certainly happy to put them into a little PDF file or something, and we can, you know, I'll talk to Donna about that and see whether that's possible. But nonetheless, you can find a lot of the information that I shared in the one book I mentioned, How to Free Your Mind, has a lot of information about Tara. She goes even into a whole commentary on the 21 Taras, which is, quite involved in terms of these 21 manifestations of this energy that can all help in different situations. Anyone want to share anything else from tonight? I don't want to put anybody on the spot, but I did look in the box, chat box, and it didn't seem that there were any questions that were there, but I'm happy to entertain questions if somebody has something they'd like to ask. Anyone? Lots of smiling faces. I'm glad I could give you something that makes you smile. There is. Oh, Ginger. Hey, Ginger.
Hey, so the green Tara sitting in the thonka and the position and her, let's see, which way is it? Her right is extended or her left side of her body?
Her right is extended, yeah.
Is the right side feminine or masculine and the left side? I guess the right side would be masculine. Then.
Yeah. Yeah, traditionally, and even in Tantra, when they symbolize that method side versus the wisdom side, they do that with the Dorje and with the bell. The Dorje represents the sort of method side, and then the bell is the wisdom realizing emptiness. So when we ring the bell in tantric practice, it's a reminder to realize the emptiness that within which things are manifesting, within which our enlightened presence is manifesting even. So, yes. Sure. Thank you for asking that, Ginger. Yeah. And Tantra is really quite interesting, but I have a weird karma with Tantra. I don't really feel like I've gained a full appreciation of it yet in my life. I always felt like, did you ever have that experience like when you arrived at a class late and everyone knew what they were doing and you didn't get the instructions? That's kind of how I feel about Tantra. But, you know, I've had to work harder then to make sure I get the instructions. But nonetheless, it's a very rich practice. But the one thing I want to make clear, because I have emphasized a lot of Tantra stuff that I did mention this earlier, but don't think that Tantra, because it is the quick path and everything, you should just head right for that, because you need the foundation of Sutra. You know, they say that the three principal aspects of the path I mentioned earlier, renunciation, bodhicitta, and emptiness, the correct view of that, without those, you can't practice Tantra effectively. And in many of the tantric visualizations, those are even the ground upon which the Buddha is sitting. So if you're doing a practice with a seated Buddha, they're often on a lotus, which represents renunciation. Then there is a sun disk, which represents emptiness. And then there is a moon disk that is sort of flat, that represents the compassionate motivation of bodhicitta. So these three things, the moon cushion, sun cushion, and the lotus, are the seat upon which one is manifesting as a Buddha. So it's absolutely essential to spend time in the sutra path before entering into the tantra path. I think there was another question or something, or comment, maybe?
Yes, yes? Donna, there was a request for another story about Tara's activity manifesting.
Oh, another story. Oh, I don't know if I have that many. I mean, some of them are my own personal stories. I'm not sure I'm ready to share those, but I don't know. And then another one was told to me by somebody from another center that I got the feeling it was told to me with some confidence. So I'm not so sure I can share those. I'll tell you a story about my own relationship with Tara that was kind of interesting. You know, many of you know, as I said earlier, I've got a nice connection with Venerable Rubina. She was living in the Bay Area when I made the decision back in 1996 to go off to the master's program in Italy and study for 7 years over there. And so in 97, as she was coming up to the center still, you know, frequently, as I was approaching my time to leave, it started in January of 98, I arrived at the center early one night for one of her teachings, and she said to me, so dear, you know, how are things going? And I said, well, you know, they're going fine. And she says, well, have you checked into getting any, you know, advice about what you might need to do, you know, what practices you might need to do, pujas you might need to do, all this stuff? And I was still fairly newbie at this. Again, my awareness of things, especially in a tantric vein, weren't all that great. But I said, no, Venerable Rubina, what should I do? And she said, well, what I would like you to do is contact this Geshe. And I think it was Geshe Lama Konchok, who was this incredible meditator who lived at part of the time he was in caves meditating, and then he would come into Kopan Monastery in Nepal. So I wrote a little email to Ani Fran, who is the nun there, and I said, could you please ask Geshe Lama Konchok for what practices or pujas I might need to do for my 7 years of study in the master's program? And, you know, I was very humbled by all of this, but he sent back just the very briefest of advice. He said, have Don recite the praises to Tara 3 times every day, and it'll all be just fine. So he gave me this advice right from there to connect with this. I'd already been doing the practice a little bit, but I hadn't really taken it to heart as an ongoing practice. And so I began reciting every day the praises to Tara 3 times. And I still do it. I mean, even though the 7 years is long gone, I've never dropped it as a practice. I do it every single day. I even do it 4 times usually just to make sure that I did 3. You know how we always add on that little extra. But, you know, I think it's something that has always sort of been there. And, of course, many of you think of Venerable Rubina as being the embodiment of that sort of green Tara energy in our world. And I see her very much in that way. So it was kind of an interesting parallel. She was the one telling me to get this advice, and through Geshe Lama Konchok, it was to connect more with Tara. You know, that green Tara has this ability. If we take great faith and confidence in that wisdom, which is our own innate wisdom that we can develop, our own inner source of all of that, well, then we can overcome all these obstacles. We can be free of any obstacles to our spiritual development. Not that I've been completely free. I'm not boasting in it by any means, saying I've never had an obstacle in my life. Trust me, I have plenty. But I've never lost the confidence that I can keep moving forward through all of that. You know, and that's what I think she's very much there to do, both Venerable Rubina and Arya Tara. So I don't know, that's maybe a little bit of a story, but I have called upon Arya Tara and made, you know, recited the praises at certain times, and things have cleared up a bit, you know, but you have to, again, don't look at it as this. I grew up Roman Catholic, and many of you, I'm sure, grew up in a Christian tradition where you have this idea that, you know, of a savior. And it's not that. You know, Tara is a savior, but only by virtue of helping you to save yourself, only by virtue of helping you to enact what will be your ultimate salvation. So don't get this impression, you know, of like Tara swooping down and, you know, taking out all the bad guys, and, you know, and then you're completely fine. You know, you have no more obstacles. So,
I have a
student on YouTube who has a question. Let me
Catch
up and read it for you.
All right.
The question is, so when we are invoking, asking for Tara's help, we are really focusing it back toward bringing out our own inner Buddha. Is that correct?
Exactly. And our own inner wisdom, you know, which is essentially something that we can tap into. I mean, this idea of Buddha nature, I mean, sometimes in some traditions it gets sort of interpreted as if like you're a Buddha already. But the idea is that you have the seeds of Buddhahood within you because you have a fundamentally pure mind. Right now, our minds are very obscured. The analogy I often use for talking about Buddha nature and the clear nature of the mind is a glass of water. You know, if I had a glass of water here and it was completely pure right out of the tap or right out of my filtration system, you know, it would be the clarity would be obvious. But, you know, our minds are like that glass of water with lots of dirt put in them. And so the dirt is there in the water and stirred up and it becomes opaque. Our minds are opaque in the same way. We're not in touch with our fundamental purity and clarity. But if we filter all that stuff out, just like you would do with putting your glass of dirty water through a very fine filter, the clear water returns. well, our clear water, our clear mind is always there as a support for all of this. It's a really amazing teaching. Again, growing up Catholic, I never got anything that reaffirmed my inner purity. It was generally that I was at fault, that I was dealing with original sin, that I was tainted and stained right from the get-go and always would be, in a sense, that Christ had to die for my sins to relieve that. And I'm not putting down that tradition by saying these things. It's just a very different philosophy. In the Buddhist tradition, you have fundamental purity within you. Tara is there to help you to get in touch with that, to be in touch with that Buddha nature, that Buddha potential, and to act from the same place that the Buddhas act, which is by getting in touch with that wisdom. So, yes, I'd say that's a good interpretation of how I put that. And Susie, did you have something to share?
I hope this isn't anticlimactic or something, but the Buddhas help us by teaching the Dharma. They can't do it for us.
Right.
How does that relate to the green light in the forest? Is that just a little assist?
Yeah, I see it as an assist. And I think we're getting assisted all the time. I mean, this is one of the reasons
mm-hmm.
why
we
want to make really deep connections with Buddhas and enlightened beings and gurus and so on, is because they can assist us to a great degree. But, you know, their assistance is still going to be conditioned to some degree by our karma. That's why Buddhists can't do everything for us. They're not omnipotent in the way that we in the Judeo-Christian tradition think of God as being omnipotent. But they have the power to help us to great lengths, depending upon the karma that we've created.
We have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So even Lama Tsongkhapa, I mean, Lama Tsongkhapa, it was an amazing being in terms of how his life was described and what have you. He was able to access not just gurus in the physical forms like we have, you know, embodied beings that grew up, were born, you know, all of that stuff, but rather he also saw his gurus manifesting in the form of Manjushri, of that Buddha of wisdom.
Yeah.
You know, so that's an assist too. That's like getting a pure view of things because you've purified your mind. As we purify our mind, things get purer in terms of what we have access to. So maybe there was some purification that was already there that allowed that green light to manifest, you know, at that center and bring this woman out of the darkness back into the center. But I don't know. I mean, it's hard to explain completely, but it is always a twofold thing. You can't say that things are completely from the side of the Buddhas because it's an interdependence. Mm-hmm. Buddhas exist because sentient beings exist, and sentient beings will be benefited by the Buddhas to the degree that their karma allows them to be benefited. That's another reason why opening up to green Tara and making supplications and requests is a healthy part of our practice, because we keep open to receiving all of that and put ourselves karmically kind of elevating to a degree where we will receive much greater benefit. The one story I mentioned that I'm not going to share with you was a story of somebody who had a really very personal experience of sort of Tara being there. Maybe I'll tell you one more of mine that I don't know. It's in retrospect. It's like something that happened that I can look back on and say that I could envision that as being Tara. Is it okay if I go a little bit over? It's all right. Okay. But way back when I was in San Francisco, of course, this was in the 80s when the HIV epidemic was very much ravaging the town. And I became very involved in volunteerism. And one of the things that I liked to do was to go work for Project Open Hand, which delivered meals to people with AIDS. And usually you'd have two people going on it. One person would be the driver in the car and the other one would be the meal deliverer. Well, the night that I came there, my delivery person wasn't there. They didn't show up. And so I had to go make the deliveries myself. So I had to park the car and then go take the meals to the houses. And parking in San Francisco is crazy. Anyway, there was one night when this happened, they had changed also the delivery list so that I was now delivering to one of the projects in San Francisco that was up on Potrero Hill, which, you know, I don't frequent. I never really had gone there. I don't know the buildings there. I don't know anything about it. Was it dark by then? Because it was in the, I think, November or December, so it was quite dark already when I was doing the meal deliveries. And I was really like, oh my gosh, you know, how am I ever going to even find this place? And frankly, it was just a little bit spooky for me, you know, at the time, you know, just where I was at. And so I ended up, this woman came out of nowhere. And she just sort of appeared there, African-American woman, and she said, can I help you with something? And I said, yeah, I'm looking for this address. And she very kindly took me there. We had a brief little conversation, and then she kind of just disappeared. I mean, I don't know. I'd never had another interaction with her. But it was very strange, you know. And in retrospect, I wasn't a Buddhist then, but maybe I, again, had some karma to be benefited at that time that could have been an enlightened being. I don't know. I think every one of us, no doubt, has had some of these kinds of experiences that in retrospect we could say maybe was Green Tara, was that sort of enlightened energy coming out to help someone because they see that it's useful at that time. You know, and I was about doing something good then, too. I'm not applauding myself, you know, or patting myself on the back. It wasn't like I was trying to find a nice nightclub to go have a drink in or something. I was trying to help others. I was trying to be a benefit. So I don't know. I can frame that one and share that one as maybe an experience of that. So again, another little thing in the chat box is about Green Tara and White Tara. There are two aspects of her. Are they more considered two different beings? Again, when we look at any of these Buddhas, they're sort of the manifestations of Buddha energy, if you will, and they can be seen not necessarily as different beings, but as different aspects, different ways of highlighting certain qualities. White Tara, again, highlighting the quality that we can call upon the Buddhas to help us to remove obstacles to shortening our lives. Every one of us, it said, sort of karmically comes in with a bit of a determined lifespan, because karmically we've set sort of the limit as to what, how long this body will last for us. But we can have premature causes of death. And so when you call upon White Tara, it's to help remove any obstacles to cutting your life short prematurely so that you can then use this life meaningfully. Again, you do it with good motivation. You don't do it so that, you know, I want to make sure I get to see as many movies on Netflix as possible before I die, so give me a long life. You know, you do it because you want to be a benefit. And so you call on White Tara to help you with that. Green Tara is the aspect of sort of that wisdom energy to help cut through other obstacles, not specifically long life, obstacles to our long life. So again, I would see them more as, again, don't think about them as being different beings. They're just different sort of facets of the enlightened mind manifesting to help us. And this is, of course, you know, I'm not getting into this idea that once you become enlightened, it's all just one big soup of Buddhahood. We could say at some level you can't differentiate much about enlightened mind when everybody is enlightened, or you talk about all the enlightened beings. But they were a particular path. They were a consciousness that was unenlightened that then became enlightened. So they will have particular karma around the beings they had connections with, and they can be really useful in that way. So they can be seen as maybe separate beings from that vantage point. But enlightened energy is dedicated to the welfare of all beings. All Buddhas want all beings to become enlightened. So they manifest in a variety of ways. Kind of, again, if you've got particular karma with a Buddha, then maybe you've got a greater chance, because you had karma with them when they were unenlightened, to receive benefit from them when they're enlightened. But I wouldn't get too much into thinking about them as separate beings as much as manifestations of that force in our world, which we want to become a part of. We want to be joining the ranks of the Buddhas to be doing this for others, to be helping them to see the wisdom of emptiness and be liberated. We should probably close pretty soon. Lots of questions coming in. As a mother with children, how can you use Tara practice, or how should be practiced to benefit your children? I don't think there's anything wrong with, again, thinking about them being the beneficiaries of your actions. This is showing your compassionate motivation. And it's always best to start with compassion for those that you feel closest to. So absolutely, you know, you can think about Arya Tara, abiding above them. Visualize your children, or if you're doing sort of mantra practice around them while they're sleeping or studying or whatever, you can visualize Arya Tara being there. And as you're reciting the mantra or the praises, think about, you know, rays of light and nectar descending down. You can think about it as five colored nectar, you know, white, red, blue, yellow, green, descending down and filling your child's children with sort of healing energy, removing their obstacles, helping them. You know, I think it's perfectly fine to do that and to, you know, tailor it for the beings that you're thinking about. But think also that, you know, by you invoking all of that to help yourself to realize emptiness, you also will then become the means of helping your children to an even greater degree when you are enlightened and have greater wisdom energy. So I don't know. Those are my thoughts on that. I don't know that there's a definitive answer to that, but I think it is useful to do these practices around our children, our pets, any being, and help them to also receive the blessings from those Buddhas. So, okay, I think I'm talked out. So I think, again, thank you all for tonight and for such attentiveness and engagement in tonight's topic. And I'll be looking forward to tomorrow night, where we talk about how we stay sane in our trying times, which seem to keep getting more trying every day. But nonetheless, you know, there are a lot of things that we hopefully can learn from the Buddha's teachings to help us. And then this weekend, just a brief thing about this weekend. This is a really interesting little text. It isn't taught on so much, but it's said to be kind of the original text in the whole corpus of what's known as Lojong, mind training, how we work with sort of our bodhicitta motivation to develop qualities based in our compassion. And these are wonderful little verses that are set up by Lama Atisha to help us to do that. I almost call them like Buddhist fortune cookie sayings. I mean, they're really quite nice and give you a lot of good stuff to work with. So I'm looking forward to sharing that with you as well this weekend. So I will turn it over to Donna and do the concluding prayers. Thank you.
Thank you, Don. Okay, let's say these in English tonight. Due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the supreme jewel bodhicitta that has not arisen arise and grow, and may that which has arisen not diminish but increase more and more. Just as the brave Manjushri and Samantabhadra too realize things as they are, I too dedicate all these merits in the best way that I may follow their perfect example. I dedicate all these roots of virtue with a dedication praised as the best by the victorious ones thus gone of the three times, so I might perform good works. And now some quick, short, long life prayers. For His Holiness the Dalai Lama, in the land encircled by snow mountains, you are the source of all happiness and good. All powerful Chenrezig Tenzin Gyatso, please remain until samsara ends. The one who mastered his speech at a very young age, the one with great patience who received the name Avatari, the one with great precision who spread the teachings of Lama Tsongkhapa on bliss and void, Lama, ornament of the yellow hat tradition, please remain until samsara ends. You who uphold the subduer's moral way, who serve as the bountiful bearer of all, sustaining, preserving, and spreading Manjana's victorious doctrine, who masterfully accomplished magnificent prayers honoring the three jewels, Savior of myself and others, your disciples, please, please live long. And now seven Tara mantras for our Geshe's long, happy lives. Om Tari Tu Re So Ha. 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 Thank you, Don.
Thank you again, Donna, and everyone at Kadampa Center, and I'm really delighted to be back with you. I wish it was in person, but nonetheless, this is the next best thing, so I'm really enjoying this, and I look forward to the week ahead. Okay, blessings to you all. Stay safe and healthy. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Good night. Good night, everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Good night. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Good night. Thank you, Donna.
Thank you, Donna. Good night, everybody. Thank you all for coming.
Yeah, have a good night.
See every single one of you tomorrow night.
All right. Bye-bye.